I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. This is a conversation with Helen Vendler, one of the great close readers of poetry and literature, maybe the most influential poetry critic in the country. Her new book is called Our Secret Discipline, about William Butler Yeats and lyric form. She's been reading and writing about Yeats for a lifetime, it seems, and yet this book starts with a certain kind of revelation. You began again at the beginning, Helen, almost.
Yes, I hadn't worked on the poems as such in a scholarly way before. I had done my dissertation on Yeats's long essay, historical essay, A Vision, and his late plays, because I thought I was much too young to write on these great poems of old age, which is what one yearns toward. So finally, I'm old enough, and I decided that I would be able to do it.
In a nutshell, what is the discovery about form itself, this changing, ever-changing shape of Yeats's poems?
I became most interested in it when I was looking at the long sequences. They may have six, they may have 10 poems linked with Roman numerals. And the poems would sometimes repeat the same form in one or two, then they'd change. Sometimes every poem in the sequence would be in a different form. And I finally began to think, is there any rhyme or reason to why poem one is in such and such a form, Ottava Rima, say? Poem two is in a stanza he invented. Poem three is a little quatrain. Poem four is in five-line stanzas, of which we don't have many in English. And I began to think there must be some reason behind his rhyme.
And it hadn't occurred to you before, in a way.
No, partly because it hadn't occurred to anybody else. We all were accustomed to say this is a sonnet, or this poem is a ballad measure, or this poem is in ottava rima, or this poem is in blank verse. But nobody had asked why, when he grouped them, he had so many different forms in one, under one title.
It reminds me a little bit of something that Eugene Lehner, a very eminent violist and quartet player, said to me once about the difference between Haydn and Beethoven quartets. The Haydn quartets were full of humor, full of genius, full of variety, full of incredible music. But he said at some level they were all the same. Mm. Beethoven reinvented the form of the quartet, and in a certain sense the piano sonata, every time he wrote one.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And Yeats, who is, I think, a modernist in his way, reinvented every form he used, too. He did marvelously inventive forms with even the most conventional forms like the sonnet or ottava rima, that eight-line stanza that he inherited from Shelley, among others. But when he touched them, he made them new. And although he said we were the last romantics, and in his themes, many of them, he is a last romantic, I think in terms of formal invention, he's the first modernist.
Meaning just what?
Well, one way to be modern was to write in free verse, and Eliot inaugurated that huge change. But another way was to take the received forms of English and say, I can invent them over again. And that's what he did, really, with everything.
What does it mean to look intensely, as you do, at the form, the structure, the shape?
There was a wonderful thing in The New Yorker a couple of weeks ago by Roz Chast in which she made a grid and said underneath it, the 15 primordial shapes or something like that. She had a spiral, she had a radial shape, she had a gradient shape. And it struck me as perfect to put in a poetry anthology because they do take shapes of that sort, ascending shapes, descending shapes, radial shapes, so that I think people don't often enough think of the graphic shape that a poem might have. In that, if you think of a poem like two of the poems I may mention, An Irish Airman Foresees His Death is four quatrains, four lines each, and they add up to, because they're four beats across, four beats across times four lines long times four quatrains adds up to a triple four, which is a symbol of perfection for Yeats, just as having, I think, eight stanzas in his beautiful Ottava Rima poem among school children. If you have eight stanzas, each of eight lines, you have a perfect square, which is, again, a symbol of perfection, I think, for him. It's not an accident, in short, that poems would take shapes for him.
Helen Bender, I would be hugely grateful if you would just teach us a Yeats poem, or two, or three, or maybe four. And maybe I'd ask you to begin with that perfect square, the poem titled An Irish Airman Foresees His Death.
The poem is 16 lines long, 4 times 4, and it's 4 beats across. Shall I read it?
Please.
Perhaps I should say first that Robert Gregory, the only son and only heir in the family, volunteered for the English Air Force in World War I and was killed after many heroic exploits by friendly fire. And Yeats wrote 4 poems about that death. This is the one that's spoken by the dead person himself, which is a daring thing to do in the first place. Most elegies take the fact of death as done and over with. But this is just before Gregory dies, and he talks about why. He asks himself, why is he doing this? Because he is fighting for England, but he's Irish, Anglo-Irish, but Irish. His loyalties are to his own townland, Kiltartan, rather than to the empire. And finally, he solves it for himself, saying that he was drawn by a lonely impulse of delight into this extraordinary new form of life, life in the air. An Irish airman foresees his death. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love. My country is Kiltartan Cross. My countrymen, Kiltartan's poor. No likely end could bring them loss or leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men, nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath, a waste of breath the years behind, in balance with this life, this death. This is one of the first airplane poems written in the 20th century. In that sense, it is inventing a new genre. We had train poems, of course, but not airplane poems. And the thing that Yeats does that to me is astonishing in this poem is that he makes the airplane take off. When the Irish airman begins speaking, he says he's on the ground, saying, I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. So he's looking up to the clouds in the sky. The clouds are above. Later, he says, a lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds, this tumult that he is now experiencing in the clouds, where he is surrounded by the clouds and is up in the air. And somehow, between line 2 and line 12, the plane has gone up into the air, and he's speaking from the air where he began speaking from the ground. And that seems to be one of the sort of amazing things that Yeats could do in a poem without telegraphing it, without saying, first I will show him speaking on the ground, then I will show him aloft in his plane. He doesn't say a word. He just makes it happen. It's all show and no tell with Yeats. At the end of this poem, there is a triple bracket of words which stands always in English for something carefully forethought of, thought out beforehand, because otherwise you wouldn't have the perfect arrangement of the words. In this case, it's a triple bracketing, A, B, C, C, B, A. And that comes to close the end of the poem. I balanced, the word is balanced, all, brought all to mind. The years to come, that's the second item after balance, the years to come, seemed waste of breath, the third item. A waste of breath, three again. The years behind, B again, to balancing the years to come, in balance with, the word balance, where we started, I balanced all, brought all to mind, and ending with, in balance with this life, this death, so that you have balance, years to come, waste of breath, years behind, balance. And that shows how perfectly he has thought it all out, because it's not the way one speaks spontaneously, making triple brackets.
Three parentheses enclosing the thought.
They're not really parentheses, of course. They're a succession of phrases that mirror each other. ABC, CBA, mirror each other in reverse. And that is the final emblem of the decision making that has led him to do this. Mm-hmm. He has been driven to it in part by a lonely impulse of delight, an aesthetic impulse, an impulse to be up in the air in a plane. But also, when he says, I balanced all, brought all to mind, he means he thought out the fact that he was his mother's only son. He thought out the past that he had spent on the family estate. He thought out his future life as heir to that estate, managing the estate. And all of that seemed nugatory in balance with this life, this death. And so the last pointing words, this life, this death, are superimposed on each other. It's the same thing, this life, this death, it's one thing. He knows that he will die. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere. But the balancing by Yeats of the aesthetic and adventurous impulse, a lonely impulse of delight, over against the thought process of shall I go back to the life I was leading or shall I do this, is written out in that careful positioning of those phrases mirroring each other.
How is it in the end that the form, the perfect square, fits the resolution here?
Actually, the poem ends the plot of the poem ends with the airman saying, a lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. He's finished with his statement. Then he does, what can you call it, a recapitulatory statement in the last four lines, in the I balanced all in balance with this life, this death. It's not part of the plot, which is standing on the ground, then taking off, then accounting for your taking off by the lonely impulse. But to add the last four lines and make it a rational decision as well as a lonely impulse is to balance thought against feeling and to say that in order to have a human decision, it can't be just instinctive or impulsive. It must also have an element of thought.
This is what we call the poet at work.
Yes, it is the poet at work. Yeats said that writing was torture, and he said a line would take him 6 hours, maybe, and that it wasn't in thinking up his themes. He often could think up the themes and write them down in prose, but it was casting them into suitable, appropriate verse that was so hard.
Would you teach us one of the familiar but always difficult Yeats poems, Sailing to Byzantium, Helen Bendler?
Yeats, when he writes the poem, takes on a certain bravado. Where should I spend my afterlife and how should I spend it? And he thinks that in Byzantium, as he says in his prose, there was a perfect coincidence of the state and religion, because the emperor used the gold smiths to make the wonderful stream of secular art that came out of the Topkapi Palace and so on, whereas the primate would be using the goldsmiths and the mosaic workers to make beautiful religious settings, the mosaics in the Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom. So he thinks, that's where I'll go to spend my afterlife. I'll go to Byzantium. There isn't the division between life and art that there seems to be in the modern world. But the question of the poem is, what will he do when he gets there? What will he be? Will he join, you might say, the religious camp, or will he join the emperor's camp? And he thinks of two possible alternative afterlives in Byzantium once he gets there. The first one he thinks about is perhaps becoming a sage in a mosaic. And then he will be in the church. He will be against the beautiful gold mosaics that are the background, standing for God's holy fire in heaven. And he will join the sages in real life, you might say, in God's holy fire, and he will sing to God in heaven, and his being will be represented by the mosaic workers who are making the mosaic of the sages, representing the sages singing God's holy fire. in my reading, at least of the poem, he decides that his afterlife, which is contained in his collected poems, the Yeats we now know and possess, is not that of a sage singing to God in a celibate company of monastic sages in heaven. Rather, what you find in the book of poems is a chronicler of time, not of eternity, and someone who has a principle of entertainment as part of his work, as well as a principle of earnestness, whereas in heaven, entertainment does not quite seem to be the function. So that he imagines himself perhaps as a sage singing in God's holy fire, represented in a mosaic, or he imagines himself as a golden bird singing to the lords and ladies of Byzantium, a heterosexual company, instead of a monastic company, and he sings of time, of what is past or passing or to come. So that briefly is the plot of the poem. Which shall I do and where will I end up? And in the meantime, he has to explain why, since he's not yet dead, why he's thinking so much about death. And we find in the second stanza of the poem that he mirrors the worldly contempt for the old. And in the third stanza of the poem, he gets closer to the heart of the matter when he says that he is still sick with desire, but his heart, his body are fastened to a dying animal, that the body no longer obeys his desire. Let me read the poem.
Please.
He's leaving the country of the young, sailing to Byzantium. That is no country for old men. The young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song. The salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl, commend all summer long whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Caught in that sensual music, all neglect monuments of unaging intellect. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. Nor is there singing school but studying monuments of its own magnificence. And therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. O sages, standing in God's holy fire as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, pern in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal it knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past or passing or to come. In leaving the country of the young in one another's arms, all the mating fish, flesh, and fowl, he shows that he can no longer participate in that sexual potency of the country of the young. And he has to find some way, he thinks, to be mind rather than body, to become a monument of unaging intellect. But there's too much gaiety, bodiness, and tragedy to become a monument of unaging intellect in his poetry. So when he becomes a little bird, instead of being part of the artifice of eternity, as the mosaics are the artifice that represent eternity, he will become part of the artifice of time, as the little bird is part of the artifice representing time. He'll be a chronicler, telling of what is past. He'll be a journalist, telling of what is passing. And he will be a prophet, telling of what is to come. And that's much closer to what we find in the collected poems than anything religious.
You surface this amazing quality of Yeats. I mean, this is a movie title now. You know, no country for old men. Mm-hmm. These lines are so resonant and so powerful and so familiar and still so never-endingly, what's the word, inviting, mysterious, uncertain.
Yes, Yeats is immensely quotable. As we all know, things fall apart, the center cannot hold, or no country for old men. But that's really because they're lodged. They're like cabochon jewels, lodged in the matrix of the line or the stanza. And each one of these stanzas is very stately. Each one is prefaced by a Roman numeral. So it's not only that the line itself is thought out and placed, but each stanza is placed so that the first, I think of these Roman numerals as asking you to sit down in a different place in each one of these four stanzas. You sit down first as you leave the country of the young. You sit down second as you have sailed the seas and come to Byzantium. You sit down third in the church, looking at the mosaics and thinking about the sages they represent and praying to the sages to come down and turn you into a sage too. And then you sit down in the emperor's palace with the lords and ladies of Byzantium. So that within the whole poem, each stanza is set like a sort of cabochon jewel, as well as items within the stanzas. It's why he's so memorable. Everything is deliberate. I don't mean that it's not inspired. It is inspired, and he works at getting inspiration too, as you can see him trying out different rhyme schemes, for instance, in the drafts. And then he will have the rhyme scheme that he wants, in this case, the 8-line rhyme scheme called Ottava Rima, that rhymes A, B, A, B, A, B, and then C, C. So it ends with a nice little neat couplet tying it up. And you can see him writing down the end words after he's decided on the rhyme. He works backwards by writing down the end words for the lines that will rhyme, the rhyming words, and then works back to fill in the lines once he has got the rhyming words.
Speaking of poems that end in a brilliant two-line summation and may have been worked backwards, would you just digress to that heartbreaking poem, Never Give All the Heart, which is 14 lines. It's not a sonnet, as you say, because it's not iambic pentameter, but it's a gorgeous construction and an incredibly memorable lesson.
This, you might say, pretends to be a didactic poem, an instruction, telling somebody else how to guard their own peace of mind, because if they give away their heart, they're never going to have any peace of mind ever again. And he thinks of the lover as always disadvantaged vis-a-vis the beloved. The lover is always deaf and dumb and blind with love. Love has blinded him with tears, as he says elsewhere of Peleus. Women always know what they're doing, so the man is always going to lose in the game of love. And the women have given themselves up to the play, and he is just stumbling around, deaf and dumb and blind with love. And therefore, you shouldn't trade in your autonomy for this kind of disability, you might say, of being in love. However, the last two lines stop being an impersonal instruction in how to keep your self-respect, so to speak, and end up being a confessional account of how he gave all his heart. Never give all the heart. Never give all the heart, for love will hardly seem worth thinking of to passionate women if it seems certain, and they never dream that it fades out from kiss to kiss. For everything that's lovely is but a brief, dreamy, kind delight. Oh, never give the heart outright, for they, for all smooth lips can say, have given their hearts up to the play, and who could play it well enough if deaf and dumb and blind with love? He that made this knows all the cost, for he gave all his heart and lost. It's in couplets, and couplets tend to be, or can be, little bitten off pieces. Two lines, two lines, two lines. They don't have the arc of development that a longer stanza like Ottava Rima might have. But because he does many things to keep the couplets from being little bitten-off pieces. He runs one couplet over into another. He puts a semicolon between the two lines of a couplet so that they don't take on that brick-by-brick masonry that they might if there was a stop at the end of each two lines.
Helen Venter, I'd love you to come to the other old age poem that all of us sort of know, The Circus Animal's Desertion, but on the way, I'm thinking of, you've quoted The Second Coming, The Center Cannot Hold. Would you teach us something of the other famous political poem, Easter 1916?
Yes, Easter 1916 is a famous and wonderful poem about the Easter Rising, as the Irish called it, the Rebellion, as the English called it. Yeats himself called it the Rebellion, using the Anglo-Irish name rather than the Republican name, the Easter Rising. On Easter Monday, there was a small uprising by patriots who wanted to found an independent republic. They knew that it was hopeless to win a battle, an armed battle with the British forces in Ireland, but they were willing to fight a battle in order to guarantee their putting up a proclamation declaring the beginning of a new Irish Republic. 16 of the rebels were executed. The one woman among them was not executed. Her sentence was commuted eventually because she was a woman and she wasn't shot. But at the end of this poem, Yeats does a roll call of the heroes. In the way in which heroes become known in history books, they're known by their last names. We say Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, Madison. At the end, these people lose their first names and become last names alone, which means that they are a part of history. On the other hand, Yeats had very mixed feelings about armed insurrection or guerrilla warfare, or indeed assassinations and bombings, because he couldn't take those means himself. He disapproved of such means. He wanted them, the patriots, to wait until the end of World War I, when England might be able to divert parliamentary attention to Ireland and give the home rule that had been promised before World War I. But the patriots didn't believe in waiting around. They thought they would strike at England when England was weakest, fighting the war overseas in France. He talks at first about the ordinary days in Dublin when he would run into these former friends of his from whom he had become estranged because of their political actions. Then he does a series of vignettes specifying certain friends without naming them at all. They're anonymous. But he thinks of the rising as a big hinge. Their lives before that were one sort of life. Their lives after it, after they were executed, after they had decided to become martyrs, was another sort of life. And at the end, he thinks, in trying to judge their actions, which he disapproved of initially, but which he now sees as historically very important, he remembers Hamlet, when the ghost of Hamlet's father says to Hamlet in the chamber scene with his mother, "Do not contrive anything against your mother. Leave her to heaven, because her case is so dubious that only heaven could judge her." And he quotes that as, "It is heaven's part to judge these martyrs, not his." In the middle of the poem, however, after the first picture of them collectively in the streets of Dublin, the second set of individual vignettes, the end, the roll call of the heroes, there's a third stanza. And the third stanza is about nature. It has nothing to do with the rising, apparently, except it identifies the patriots as the unnatural thing, the stone, that is the only thing that doesn't move and change, and it troubles the living stream. The refrain of this poem is changed, changed utterly. The patriots have been changed. It's a passive verb. They have been changed. Whereas in the third stanza about nature, nature changes minute by minute. It's the active stanza of change, a sort of scherzo over against the heavy, all changed, transformed utterly. The patriots didn't transform themselves. It was their execution by the British that transformed them into heroes. So there's the principle of what should you say, martyrdom and execution, which is inflicted on you from the outside, versus the natural impulse to keep changing as all of nature changes all the time. So the third stanza, which is the only one without that refrain of a terrible beauty is born, is a rebuke to the other stanzas, nature rebuking ideology or ideological fixity. Let me read it.
Please.
Easter, 1916. I have met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among gray 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head, or polite, meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn. All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers, when, young and beautiful, she rode to harriers? This man had kept a school and rode our winged horse. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. This other man I had dreamed a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart. Yet I number him in the song. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter, seem enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. A shadow of cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse plashes within it. The long-legged moorhens dive, and hens to moorcocks call. Minute by minute they live, the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? That is heaven's part, our part to murmur name upon name as a mother names her child when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? No, no, not night, but death. Was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. We know their dream, enough to know they dreamed and are dead. And what if excessive love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse, McDonough and McBride and Connolly and Peirce, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born.
A terrible beauty is born. Take apart that contradiction of a terrible beauty. And well, also the wearing of the green.
The wearing of the green is, as you know, a ballad saying of Ireland, she's the most distressful country that ever yet was seen for the hanging men and women for the wearing of the green, which was true. If you wore a shamrock, you could be executed for it for treason, apparently. I'm not sure it's historically true. But certainly if you exhibited Republican energies, you would be imprisoned and perhaps executed as these men were. When Yeats wrote this poem, he writes it in a three-beat line, which is a quick march. One, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three. A slow march is one, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. But in this quick march, all the stanzas except the one about nature end with a refrain, and we associate refrains with ballads. They tend to have echoes at the end, "For I'm weary with hunting and fain would lie down," as Lord Randall says at the end of each of his stanzas, so that all of it is linked to the ballad tradition by the refrain, by the fact that it's a quick stanza, not 4-3-4-3 like the ballad, but 3-3-3-3, a speeded-up ballad, you might say, stanza, and also that refrain. And then the third stanza stands there as a rebuke to everything that is not natural, including ideology, guerrilla warfare, anything that makes people think of only one thing. Because in nature, hens are calling to moorcocks, is the natural sexual cycle reproducing itself, whereas ideologues remove themselves almost entirely from the natural cycle of family life and of every other kind of natural life, amusement, everything. They're just the stone. Their hearts have turned to stone.
So what is the beauty part in the end?
The beauty is the founding of the Republic. That is, it's as though a Platonic idea suddenly stood before you, radiant in its allegorical raiment, like liberty or justice, those people we imagine as those marble statues holding flags, or like the symbol of France, Marianne with her flag, as if one of those things that people talked about had suddenly become real and was standing before you, a free Ireland. And that's a very powerful image. Ireland is usually represented as female, too. So that I also believe, although nobody else does, that he took, in part, the phrase "a terrible beauty," which occurs in previous literature, in things that Yeats himself had read, and that Maud Gonne said in a kind of, his beloved said in an opposite way. She said, tragedy has returned to Ireland. And if you think of Aristotelian definitions of tragedy, there is pity and terror, there is beauty as well as terror. But Blake, when he was writing about the revolutionary tiger, called it an instance of fearful symmetry, where you have the adjective that is terrible and the noun, which is an aesthetic noun, symmetry, beauty, fearful, terrible. And I think that he was thinking of the revolutionary tiger in Blake as well, the fearful symmetry. What the hand, you know, what the shoulder, what the art. And there is something about that tiger that for me haunts the 1916.
Fascinating. Helen Bender, he sums up his whole life in The Circus Animal's Desertion and reviews it in a very powerful close. Would you read that for us and teach us that poem?
This is an interesting poem because usually each of his Roman numerals came before one stanza, as in Sailing to Byzantium, place one, place two, place three, place four. Here you have a place one with a Roman numeral one in front of it. Then you have a place two, which has three stanzas behind it. The second place is big. It has three whole stanzas. And then you have a coda, the third place. So you have a prelude, a body, and a coda, each one of them bearing a Roman numeral, one, two, three. The prelude talks of writer's block, as we would call it today. In fact, Yeats had been looking for a theme to write about, he says, for 6 weeks. And in fact, if you look at his letters, it turns out to be true. Day one, day seven, day 13, day 22, day 35, and he still has nothing to write about. And it is, of course, making him feel that he'll never write another poem when you go that long without thinking of anything to write about. So that the prelude is about not being able to write, and it imagines him in the past as the ringmaster of a circus. And he would just tell his images to come out and jump through hoops, and they would. And when he speaks about his images that he commanded from his ringmaster's perch for his year-round circus, mostly circuses used to go around in the summer because they were open air, but his was on summer and winter. He says he never let his circus stop. And when he speaks of his circus animals, among them are women and boys, and that's a rather chilling way to speak of human beings as your circus animals that you can order around. In the coda, he finds out that he had themes all along that he was refusing to look at, so that it was a defensiveness and denial in him that made him not have anything to write about. In the meantime, in the second place, he says, what can I but enumerate old themes? So the body of the poem, in the body of the poem, he's trying sort of to prime the pump by reminding himself that he was a writer once, and he wrote lots of good things, among them plays. He talks about his plays and reproaches himself for saying, all my work came out of heart mysteries, but as soon as I started to work as a writer, I forgot all about the heart mysteries and was all wrapped up in the plot that I was writing about, and reproaches himself in the first two summaries of his plays for that. In the third stanza about the plays, he begins to talk about his playwriting in another way, in a much more serious way, and in a way that I think he is deriving from Aristotle's Poetics. He talks about his writing in that third stanza of Retrospection. He talks about his plays as character, isolated by a deed to engross the present and dominate memory. Those are very severe words, and when you think about them, they are Aristotle's tragic heroes, character, isolated by a deed to engross the present and dominate memory. And they're not hapless dreams. They are monuments of unaging intellect. But by the time he gets to thinking of his plays as not escapes from reality, but embodied reality, he's much happier. But that doesn't help him. He's still been enumerating old themes. And finally, he finds the place he has to lie down in the third part of the poem, the coda. The circus animal's desertion, one. I sought a theme and sought for it in vain. I sought it daily for 6 weeks or so. Maybe at last, being but a broken man, I must be satisfied with my heart. Although winter and summer till old age began, my circus animals were all on show, those stilted boys, that burnished chariot, lion and woman, and the Lord knows what. Two. What can I but enumerate old themes? First, that sea rider machine, led by the nose through three enchanted islands, allegorical dreams, vain gaiety, vain battle, vain repose, themes of the embittered heart, or so it seems, that might adorn old songs or courtly shows. But what cared I that set him on to ride? I starved for the bosom of his fairy bride. And then a counter-truth filled out its play. The Countess Kathleen was the name I gave it. She, pity-crazed, had given her soul away, but masterful heaven had intervened to save it. I thought my dear must her own soul destroy, so did fanaticism and hate enslave it. And this brought forth a dream, and soon enough this dream itself had all my thought and love. And when the fool and blind man stole the bread, Cuchulainn fought the ungovernable sea. Heart mysteries there. And yet when all is said, it was the dream itself enchanted me. Character, isolated by a deed to engross the present and dominate memory. Players and painted stage took all my love, and not those things that they were emblems of. Three. Those masterful images, because complete, grew in pure mind, but out of what began? A mound of refuse, or the sweepings of a street, old kettles, old bottles, and a broken can, old iron, old bones, old rags, that raving slut who keeps the till. Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart.
The heart is transformed.
It certainly is transformed. And what's in the heart are all the leftovers of his poems. Mm. The swords become old iron, and cauldrons of Lugh, the god, become old kettles. And everything is now used up, got grown old, decrepit, like himself, But if he's going to have any themes, those will have to be his themes, not the themes of young love or even heroism as in Cuchulainn.
Why do we love this so, especially men of a certain age? It's a guy poem. It's a sort of fighting exhaustion poem, and it's a Robert Bly book title, but it's part of our consciousness now.
I'm not so sure it's not for both sexes, having known some exhaustion myself lately. But it is one of the poems that makes you go down to bedrock truth, uncovering layers of denial. Of course it's nicer to be able to write poems about young love or poems about heroic warriors like Cuchulainn. But there comes a time in life when those are not your themes anymore. And whatever way you find to confront your own decrepitude is modeled for us by him, where he goes into the foul rag and bone shop of the heart for the first time, not thinking of heart mysteries, but of heart contents, and also thinking that the beloved, the fairy bride whose bosom he was starving for when he wrote his poem, The Wanderings of Oisin, has turned into the raving slut that keeps the till. Anybody can have her if they pay. And he leaves unarticulated what you have to pay each time you take out one of these themes and try to make it into a poem. But you have to pay in the foul rag and bone shop. It is a shop. And the muse has turned into a raving slut because, as he said in another poem, to Lady Dorothy Wellesley, who reproached him for the grimness of some of his late poems. It's a poem called The Spur. You think it horrible that lust and rage should dance attendance upon my old age. They were not such a plague when I was young. What else have I to spur me into song? And so the lust and rage of the foul rag and bone shop are the spur to song now, and it's no use looking back to more winning themes.
Helen Bender, it's a privilege to sit with you on a December night with the sound of snow shovels outside, hearing these poems. We summon the spirit of the man himself. Thank you. And is there a last word as we plunge into our own readings of the great man?
Yeats was very lucky to be able to write well until he died. His last two poems were composed and dictated from his deathbed. And I think that's the greatest luck any artist can have, is to be writing so well until his last breath. Most artists can't do that.
Thank you, Helen Vendler.